Tungdil who kissed her. He placed his hands on Circa's slim hips and pulled her to him. He could smell the intense perfume on her neck, could feel the warmth of her body through the thin tunic. His hands wandered up to the laces of her gown. Then his conscience flared up. "No," he said hoarsely and quickly stepped away. "I belong to another." But Circa followed him and embraced him. "What does that mean, belong?" He avoided her and put a chair between the two of them. "Circa, you flatter me," he said, trying hard to control his feelings and not give in to her urging. "But I am tied to Belindis, and as long as that is so, I cannot allow myself to indulge in an adventure like this." She laughed. "Oh, I understand. You people go in for lasting relationships. Don't you?" "No. We love for as long as we like. When feelings change, we part. Perhaps for a while, perhaps forever. It makes life easier, Tungdil. Life is short enough." Circa gazed at him. "You're looking for something new? How would this be? Accompany us to Letaphora. On the way, I'll tell you everything you need to know about our people. Letaphora is a town, one of many in my homeland, and very different from towns in Gerdlegard." "Yes," he said, without a moment's hesitation. "That would be delightful," he added more thoughtfully. She laughed and gave him another kiss, running her fingers through his hair and stroking his beard. "That would be delightful," she repeated as she went to the door. "We shall be seeing a lot of each other, Tungdil. I shall teach you well. The lesson you missed today, we can take up again at leisure." She opened the door and left the room. Tungdil sat down. He was aflame, with her scent still in his nostrils and the taste of her mouth in his own. Circa had captured him with her open, unaffected manner. It was not only her physical charms he was thinking of. He was looking forward to the lessons she had promised him. But first, he would send a letter to Glaimbar and talk to Belindis. Or better still, he would write her a long letter. He took a sheet of paper and wrote a few lines to Glaimbar first, sealing the note and laying it on the table in front of him. Then he started the letter to his consort Belindis, ending his relationship with her. Not an easy task, even for a scholar like himself. The words would not flow smoothly from the pen. He was struggling. He wrote that he would never be able to make her happy, not in the long term. Not how she would wish it. And the long term for his people was a very long time. He did not want to do this to her. Meeting the undergroundling woman was only a prompt for this parting. He had long been aware in himself that things were not as they should be, but he had always sought the reason elsewhere. He had never been more certain than now that Belindis deserved better than this. In his choice of phrasing, he was scrupulous to take the blame on himself and not to give her the impression that she bore any responsibility for the failure of their partnership. His lines would affect her harshly, all the same. This letter, too, he sealed and laid on top of a note to Glaimbar. There was no going back. The meeting with Circa brought home to him what was missing in his life. Passion. Something new. Scholarship and the spirit of inquiry were his curse. He did not want safety and shelter. "Fracas! What malleable stone did you take when you formed me?" he sighed. He had absolutely no desire to attend the theatre performance. Gerdlegard, Kingdom of Goregar, Parista, Summer 6241st Solar Cycle. Tungdil woke with a start. He must have dropped off over his notes, and in the meantime night had fallen in Parista. Standing up and stretching his aching back, he heard the vertebrae click back into place. Sleep had brought no brilliant ideas about how to catch the elves out and expose their malice. He had no evidence, only the undergroundling's warnings and his own observations back in Allendore. The elf they had found in the forest was still lying unconscious in the guesthouse on the edge of town, where they had left him guarded by 10 soldiers. They had managed to keep his presence quiet. If only he'd come round. Tungdil shook his head. He picked up the tankard of beer. This particular temptation must be removed before he went to bed. He opened the window and chucked the contents out. It splashed onto the cobbles. The danger was past. Why isn't everything that simple? A shadow swung down from the roof and in through the window, striking him on the chest. Tungdil crashed back and hit his head on the edge of the table. He saw stars. 3 black-garbed figures leapt in. Their faces were masked, and they carried short swords. 1 secured the door, and the other 2 pinioned Tungdil's arms. A blade was pressed against his throat. "Where is it?" whispered a female voice. "Where is what?" "Keenfire," she hissed. "Hey, thickets!" said the man at the door, pointing to where the axe hung in its case from a protruding beam against the wall. "Samusin is with us." "It's going to be easier than I thought," she laughed. "I was afraid we'd have to deal with that mad fighting dwarf and his apprentice as well." The man next to her stood up and reached for the axe. This galvanized Tungdil into action. He jerked his head to one side and thrust the blade away, forcing it into the woman's unprotected thigh. He reaped a small cut on his hand, but she received a deep slash on her leg. "It's mine!" he yelled, drawing his knife. He had soon realized that these intruders were not trained assassins or experienced thieves. They were mere beginners, and he was eager to find out why they had set their sights on the most important weapon in Girdlegard. The woman yelped with pain, and he whacked her on the forehead with the handle of his dagger so that she collapsed on the floor. He set after the man who had just grabbed the axe, stabbing him from behind in the leg. The man roared and spun round, swinging Keenfire to attack him. Tungdil ducked, and the tip of the axe buried itself in a wooden post. "Let go!" growled Tungdil threateningly, leaping forward knife in hand to force his adversary to retreat. The man crashed against a chest of drawers, and the blade struck him in the side. He broke off, cursing, and pressed his hands over the spurting wound. Tungdil wrenched the axe out of the wooden beam and whirled it in his hands. Watchfully, he approached the last of the 3 masked intruders. "Now tell me who you are and how you got the crazy idea to steal Keenfire from me." The man brandished his short sword, the blade quivering. "Get back!" "On the contrary." Tungdil feigned an axe blow, and while the other was trying to dodge it, he kicked him in the groin so he sank groaning to his knees. Tungdil placed the heavy blade at his neck to let him feel its deadly pressure. "Well?" "Kill us, and you'll never see Lot Ionan again." The woman spoke, pulling herself upright on the post. She let herself fall, groaning, onto a chair and examined the wound in her thigh. "So you're the ones who stole him?" "I said right at the start that it was a stupid idea to steal the dwarf's axe," moaned the man who had been stabbed in the side. "Get a medicus. I'm bleeding to death here." "No one leaves this room till I know who you are." Tungdil stood threateningly at the door. The woman pulled off her face mask and used the cloth to bind her wound. She was no older than 18 cycles. A hank of light brown hair had escaped from her headscarf. "I'm Rhysifer of Panic. That's Dergard, and he's Lamostin. We were Nodons for Muli, and ever since his death when the force fields were lost, we've been trying to find a way to bring magic back to Girdlegard," she revealed to the astonished dwarf. She stood up and limped over to where the injured man lay. "What do you want with Lot Ionan's statue if you were followers of Nodon?" Rezava looked at the men, who both took off their masks. "We were going to try to free him from the spell. He can help us. Our land needs the skills of magic so that we can stop the creatures who are hunting down the diamond." Her face darkened. "If you had only listened to Nadon, this would never have happened." Tungtil thought she must be joking. Andakai said the petrification spell was irreversible. "Perhaps for Andakai it was." Rezava spoke with disdain. "Have a care," warned Lamostin. "Don't tell him too much." "Wrong," Tungtil stroked his axe. "Tell him everything. It is better for your health. You can still cast spells if you need be without your foot." Rezava moved back and spoke to her companions. Tungtil did not take his eyes off them and readied himself to prevent them escaping. At last she turned back to him. "Right, I'll explain. Andakai did not have the knowledge that we have. We have spent the last few cycles studying Nudine's secret library and learning magic spells. In theory. But we do not have the magic energy to give life to the formulae." Rezava indicated the axe. "We thought we'd be able to get enough magic force from Keenfire to free Lot Ionan. He would know what to do. He would never teach you." Tungtil did not dare to believe what she was saying. He could not tell whether she was speaking the truth or not. "Nadon or Nudine, no matter now, he is dead," said Durgard, still holding his privates in agony. "We mourned him for long enough to know his views had been corrupted by the demon within. He had no free will any more." He looked at Rezava. "She'll understand. In our hearts, we renounced Nadon long ago. As she said, we have Nudine's knowledge and want to continue his works. His works, not Nadon the traitor's. Lot Ionan would have taken us on, I'm sure of it." Stealing the statue wasn't a good start. Tungtil took the axe away from the neck of the Famulus. "You should have told me and King Bruron." "He'd not have believed us any more than the people of Girdlegard or you." Rezava stood up carefully, leaning on a chair. "We want to bring Lot Ionan back to life. The humans, the elves, the dwarves, they all have faith in him. He would have found a way to present us as his new initiate pupils without our reputation going before us." Tungtil stepped past her to check the injured man's wounds. "The wound in the leg isn't bad, and the left side will heal quickly," he said after a swift inspection. "We'll clean it up and get you stitched up. Then you should have some bed rest for a few orbits until it is all healed over." He looked at Rezava. "You will take me and my friends to the statue. You may have Keenfire, and you can try to revive Lot Ionan with it." His eyes took on a threatening glint. "But if you try any treachery, you and your friends will be killed. At the moment, you are no use to Girdlegard, so it makes no difference whether you're around or not." "It's a waste of time," said Lamostin through clenched teeth. "I was holding the axe in my hands, and there's not enough magic in it. It won't be of any use for our plan. The magic source." Rezava bent down and touched his wound, as if by mistake. The rest of his sentence disappeared in a howl of pain. For Tungtil, the hint was enough. He grabbed her arm and twisted it. "You know about the source." Rezava stared at him stubbornly and remained silent. "Tell him," said Durgard. He took a deep breath to relieve the pain in his side. "Perhaps he knows what we can do. The fate of Girdlegard is at stake now, not just our own futures as Famuli." "So, what are you supposed to tell me?" Tungtil increased the pressure on her arm. Her wrist would soon snap. "It'll be difficult to do magic without your arm." She clenched her teeth, tears streaming down her face. "I'll turn you to ashes with a single spell," she grunted. "But you can't," he replied, twisting further. There was a grating sound. "Speak now, or watch your bones stick out through the skin." Rezava moaned. "A new magic source," she stuttered. He let go of her arm. She curled up in pain, her forearm against her chest. "We have found a new source. But it's in Weyen, under the lake. It's too deep to get to." Tungtil felt enormous relief. He felt elated for the first time. There was going to be an answer to the threat from the Unslayables. Lot Ionan, the submerging island, and the Famuli, together they gave him the answer to the prayers he had sent up to Vrakus. But he forced himself to conceal his feelings. If they really had Nudin's archive and had studied his spells, they must not be allowed to learn that it might be possible to get down to the lake bed. Not until Lot Ionan was restored to life and could decide for himself. "We shall see what we can come up with," he said calmly. "First, take me and my friends to where the statue is. Lot Ionan shall be in my care from now on."
"What are you going to come up with that hasn't already occurred to us?" objected Rezava. "The water is many hundred paces deep according to the fishermen we've asked. No diver can get near. If you could get down, you'd never get back up."
"My race has achieved many things," he smiled at her. "Now, let's get some of my friends, and we'll bring the statue to safety." Tungdil opened the door, one hand still keeping keen fire at the ready. Durgard pointed to Lemostin.
"What about him?"
Tungdil gave him an encouraging glance. "A medicus will come and see to him, as soon as we have the statue." He waved the others out, closed the door, and blocked it from the outside using a flagstaff that he'd taken off the wall, jamming it under the door handle. The performance was going very well. The great and the good of Gerdlegard were sitting in the Curiosum watching the action on stage with refined smiles. The script was from Tassia's pen. Those who were not so great and good were splitting their sides with laughter. The combination of Tassia's acting talent and her undoubted physical charms had enthralled the audience. Rodario, not needed in this first act, was watching the spectators happily, if slightly enviously, through a hole in the scenery. Tassia was his creation, but she was getting all the attention these days. She was overtaking him in theatre hierarchy here, in his own troupe and in front of his own audience.
"Look, Fergus," he whispered. "The men adore her, and the women admire her."
"You've conjured your rival up yourself," the props man retorted quietly, as he checked the strings that control the smoke colours and the flames, anything to do with his special stage effects. He had spent the preceding orbits sorting out any small hiccups in the various contraptions. Time had not left his inventions unscathed. But now everything ran like clockwork. The scenery changed by itself, with the sun rising and sinking automatically. Trees moved in the wind, and Fergus had even introduced some artificial forest smells to make the illusion complete.
"Have I said how glad I am to have you back with us?" Rodario said seriously.
"Because I've repaired everything," his friend grinned. Rodario turned to face him.
"Not only that," he smiled back, clapping him on the shoulder. "I'm very glad to be out of the clutches of the Thirdlings. I'm in your debt."
When the cue came on stage, Fergus tugged the yellow string, and the lamp above Tassia went dark. The light faded gradually, the sun set, and the night sky was revealed to murmured appreciation from the audience. The actor laughed out loud.
"You're working off your debt to me splendidly!"
A door flew open, and Tungdil stepped into their narrow space backstage.
"Oh, sorry! I thought it was the side entrance."
"It is for the actors," hissed Rodario.
"Quiet! You're much too late for the performance. We haven't got any more seats, but you can watch from the gangway. I will give permission," he said graciously. "There'll soon be a free seat. I need Ironheart."
He pushed Rodario aside and looked through the spyhole to find his friend in the audience.
"What's happened?" asked Fergus tensely. "Have the monsters arrived?"
"No. Something good's happened at long last," he whispered happily. "Three Famuli have turned up. They stole Lot Ionan's statue, and they tell me there's a way to bring him back to life. One of them's injured, up in my room. I'm going off with the other two to collect the statue."
"By Palandiel, can it be true?"
Rodario bent down.
Shall I stop the performance?
No. I want to be absolutely sure they've got the statue, and I want it in my hands before we tell anyone else.
Tongdil beamed at him.
And they know where the source is.
What source? Fergus pulled the red string now, letting a cloud of fog rise onto the stage.
The source? The magic source, exactly. The one the monsters get their power from.
He hurried to the corridor that led to the auditorium.
I will tell you more later, he said excitedly. I've got to get on now.
He nodded to them both.
There's hope, great hope.
Then he disappeared. Watching through the spy hole, Rodario saw Tungdil go up to Ironheart and Goda. The three of them left the marquee at once.
What do you say to that? He smiled. It's just one momentous occasion after another. I've got more material than I can ever turn into plays.
He stroked his beard.
I'll start up another Curiosum, he decided. Tassia can run it. What do you think?
Smart idea, Rodario, said Fergus. That's the way to sideline your rival. Promote her.
Rodario nodded.
Exactly. And she'll be eternally grateful to me. Love-making, right? Left and centre, nights of passion whenever I knock on her door.
He heard his cue and adjusted his costume before he stepped out through the curtain on stage, winking at Fergus.
I'm terribly pleased with myself.
The scene was an adaptation of the time Nolik had stormed into his caravan. Here, on stage, the number of attackers had obviously been increased for the sake of the action. The fight for Tassia's affections and the struggle for the jewellery were even more dramatic. Soon the ruffians lay senseless on the floor or had taken flight.
And thus love and a sword triumph over adversity, Rodario addressed the spectators.
Tassia joined him, holding up the necklace.
And the necklace makes up for everything I had to endure.
The thin gold shimmered and glowed. The rock crystal flashed in the lamplight from the stage and sent sparks dancing over the audience, over humans, dwarves and elves. Tassia threw herself into Rodario's embrace.
What are you going to give me to make up for what I shall have to endure with you?
She asked, fluttering her lashes.
The diamond!
Came a shout from the audience.
No, not a diamond.
Rodario picked up the cue.
Not a diamond! I shall give you my heart.
Gandagar leaped onto the stage, his right hand closing over the pendant.
Lights! He shouted.
Your Royal Highness! Noble Majesty, High King of all the Dwarf Realms, sire. I know your people are awfully keen on gems and jewellery, and that you get really passionate about them. But you are ruining my play, said Rodario, politely but with impatience.
He grabbed the necklace.
Go and sit down again, your Majesty, and watch the final act. I rule here on this stage. You will be good enough to recognize my status.
Gandagar pulled the jewel out of his hands again.
This is one of the diamonds, you idiot thespian, insisted the king. Can't you understand?
Rodario laughed.
Your connoisseur's eye has been deceived here, your noble majesty.
Faster than the dwarf could react, Rodario had taken possession of the necklace.
This pendant is made of polished rock crystal, not diamond.
He swung it from his hands.
It is paste, your majesty. I would never use a genuine precious gem as a stage prop. I am the king of the Fourthlings. My tribe is descended from the best gemstone cutters amongst the children of the smith, and if anyone knows about jewels, then it's going to be me, not some actor.
He retorted so angrily that his beard quivered.
Give me the diamond, at once!
Tassia tried to mediate, but just then a huge creature mounted the stage. It was taller than dwarf or human, and thick strings of twisting muscle showed under its grey-green skin. Apart from a leather loincloth and boots, it was naked. Round its forearms, white chains hung. Its contorted alfar gaze was focused on the pendant, the eyes glowing green. Give me the necklace!
Everyone in the auditorium stared in surprise. King Brauron was the first to applaud.
What a magnificent performance, he called. The creature looks just like the one Tungdil and the soldiers described.
Totally lacking in taste, complained Issachar.
Rodario and Tassia stepped back. The actor held up his sword.
Run, Gandogar,
he said hoarsely, horror compressing his larynx. Hastily he thrust the jewel at him.
Save the last of the stones from Teon's creatures!
Then mayhem broke out in the theatre marquee. Chapter 11 Gerdlegard, Kingdom of Goregar, Parista, Summer 6241st Solar Cycle. Rizava stopped outside an anonymous-looking house wedged in between properties that reflected the status of wealthier owners.
Here it is.
She opened the door and went in. Tungdil, Sirka, Boindil, Goda, and 24 dwarves followed her in, prepared for action. The wagon, lined with straw, was ready in the street outside. They saw at once that the building had not been occupied for some time. There was a layer of dust on the furniture. Only the tables and chairs showed frequent use. It all smelled of cold smoke.
We come here because of the cellar, said Rizava,
who had come to a halt in the entrance. She touched a special place on the wall, and steps appeared, leading down, when a stone slab moved aside. From the vaulted basement, Tungdil caught the familiar smell of paper and parchment.
Is this Nudin's library?
No, it's mine, said the woman, lighting a lamp and leading the way.
Soon they were all crowded into the small cellar room, with walls full of shelves and books. In the middle stood Lot Ionan's petrified statue, inside a circle drawn with magic symbols. Several runes had been sketched on the surface of the statue itself.
We've got everything ready, she explained. All we need to revive him is the magic. How did you get him here?
Rizava indicated the steps.
Carried him down. It took nearly all night.
Ironheart walked round the statue.
There are a few bad scratches, he said, running his fingers over the grooves.
Tungdil examined the damage. It was a strange feeling. Was he looking at a statue or a person? Perhaps Lot Ionan would soon be emerging from the stone. The Magus he had lived with for so many cycles, his own foster father. They could not afford to make any mistakes.
Should we fill the marks in with mortar before trying to bring him to life? We can't have him bleeding.
He saw a hole in the stone robe near the spine.
Or he might fall down dead.
What do you think?
He passed his query to the Famuli.
Dergard shook his head. I wouldn't do that.
He studied the hole, a finger's width. He seemed surprised.
I didn't see that before. Could have been rats or something else like that.
I agree.
Tungdil ordered the dwarves to get the carrying belts from the wagon. It would be like a foreign body to introduce mortar into his flesh. If it wasn't part of him when he was turned to stone, then it won't be changed back when he's restored to life.
Ironheart bent down, picking up some of the powder he saw on the floor. Stone dust.
He scratched around the opening.
It all fits. This hole has been drilled on purpose.
He turned to Rizava and Dergard.
I don't know of any animal outside of the mountains that eats stone.
The two humans looked at each other helplessly.
I swear by Samusin it wasn't us, said Rizava. Perhaps a fourth Famulis, still loyal to Nadon, and who wants to see Lot Ionan dead, suggested Goda. The hole was concealed. It was probably to serve as a fallback in case we managed to bring him back to life.
Then they would have knocked his head off, apprentice,
Ironheart said, looking at her crossly.
That should cost you 50 push-ups, but I'll be generous.
Tungdil tore an empty page out of the book, rolled the paper into a spill, and pushed it into the hole to see how deep it went.
As deep as my little finger.
A person should be able to survive that. He ran his hands over the statue. And anyway, he'd be able to heal himself at once. We must just risk it.
The dwarves came back with the leather harness. With a combined effort, they managed to load the stone figure of the Magus onto the wagon, bedding it down on the straw.
The diamond!
The monster's dark eyes shone green as it shook the chains free from its forearms. The Alphar symbols glowed and transferred their light to the iron links. Then it swung the chains at Rodario and Gandagar. Both were caught within the coils. At the next moment, and before any of the spectators could move, the creature launched itself into the air, catapulting straight through the stage scenery, dragging its captives after it, as if they weighed nothing at all. Pieces of the stage flats broke off and fell down, one of them hitting Tassia and trapping her while dwarves and soldiers rushed off in pursuit.
Help!
She sobbed. Planks collapsed, bringing down sections of canvas from the tent. Smoke started to rise. Tassia could hear people stampeding past her to escape from the monster. There was no time to come to the aid of some actress. At last, Fergus came over to free her from her distress. She wept and threw herself at him, grabbing hold of his shoulder. He froze. Finally, he put his arms hesitatingly around her and consoled her.
Come along. Let's get you out of here.
He yelled orders to the theatre group, most of whom were standing rooted to the spot in terror. They must put out the fires. He carried Tassia out and sat her on a makeshift bed.
You'll be safe here, he said. I must go and save Rodario.
She nodded and calmed down, but the pain, coupled with the shock of the monster's appearance, had hit her hard. Fergus ran off, following the sounds of commotion. He could see from Parista's lighted windows that the townspeople had been aroused. It wasn't long before he found a crowd of soldiers and dwarfs surrounding Rodario and Gandagar. Whereas the actor had got away comparatively lightly, the monster had torn off Gandagar's forearm. The dwarf king lay unconscious on the cobbles, being attended to by a healer who was binding up the stump. Rodario was bleeding from numerous cuts and grazes. Both he and the High King had burn marks on their clothing from the red-hot chains. He was holding his head.
Awful, he said indistinctly. I was nearly dragged to my death. It has the strength of 20 horses.
He looked over at Gandagar.
This courageous dwarf refused to give up the diamond and actually attacked the monster. It simply wrapped the chain around his arm and yanked.
He turned pale and covered his mouth with his hand.
I mustn't think of it. Where did it go? One of the soldiers asked. I don't know, Rodario pointed up to the roofs. It made one great leap and disappeared. It had no trouble getting right up to the rooftop and then jumped to the next one. You won't catch it now. It'll be over the city walls.
Bruron appeared, surrounded by his bodyguards. He saw he had arrived too late.
"Summon the assembly!" he commanded one of his servants. "And get Tongdil Goldhand! We need to make a new plan, and must hurry if we are to save Gertlegard. There's no doubt now that the Unslayables possess all the diamonds!"
Cursing, he turned and walked back to the tent. Fergus gave Rodario a helping arm.
How is Tassia?
She has a scratch on her shoulder, Fergus told the actor calmly. Nothing serious.
Amazing!
Rodario looked up at the rooftops as if he could still see the monster. I had the most powerful of the gems and had not noticed. He gave a wry laugh.
I'm stupid enough not to be able to tell a crystal from a diamond.
Fergus patted his shoulder.
Don't fret. You didn't know what the stone looked like. It wouldn't have helped if you had known. It wouldn't have stopped this catastrophe.
Rodario nodded and fell silent.
Hey, take care, you clumsy idiots, or you'll have his nose off,
Ironheart called with a grin.
He'd turn you into a gnome for that.
The dwarves, sweating with the effort of heaving up Lotionen's statue, laughed and renewed their endeavours to lower the Magus gently down. Then they heard the alarm boom out through the night. There was no more peace and quiet in Perista now.
"What does that mean?" growled Ironheart. "Are they hunting down the impresario?"
There was a clink, and a green glowing iron chain shot down from the sky, coiling itself around Rizava's neck. She grabbed at it, gasping for breath, but at once skin, muscles and vertebrae were ripped apart as if made of paper and rotten wood. The torso remained upright for a moment, then collapsed convulsing to the ground. Blood pumped out of the neck stump. The Famula's head fell to the cobbles with a dull thud.
"Stand against the wall!"
Tungjil ran to the side and pressed himself against the side of the house to give the whipping chains no chance. He raised Keenfire and looked up.
"The damned froggy," growled Boindil. "This time you won't get away. I'm going to pull off your fine legs and I'll have you crawling. You will pay for ruining my beard."
The creature scurried over the roofs to right and left, covering huge distances effortlessly. Every so often, it would show itself to the dwarves to mock them.
"What does it want here?"
Goda wondered, not taking her eyes off the roofline. Tungdil looked at Rizava's corpse.
"It must have felt that hope was emerging for Girdlegard."
He turned to Dirgard and signalled 10 dwarves over to protect him.
"Ironheart and Goda, you lead them. The rest go with me," he ordered,
running off to the wagon on which Lotionen lay.
"Let's get him away from here."
The chains hissed close and tore both the dwarves nearest to Tungdil screaming into the air. They crashed down, ripped in two halves as if a giant child had broken and dropped them. Then the creature leaped onto the street to face Tungdil, bared its teeth triumphantly, and let the chains sway and dance.
"I shall kill you all," it promised in a clear voice.
A jerk with one arm was sufficient, and the chain killed one of the undergroundlings as the tip smashed the dwarf's head. Circa appeared at Tungdil's side.
"Let's get going.
I'll distract it and you strike,"
she said earnestly, attacking the monster without waiting for Tungdil's reply. While she was moving in on the creature, the second chain came whipping out and wrapped itself around her weapon, making the iron glow red-hot. With a scream, the undergroundling released her hold, but she was not giving up. She drew a dagger and stabbed at the monster. Tungdil swung Keenfire, swiveled on his heel, and slashed at the thigh of his huge opponent. The axe flamed up, diamonds blazing out a cold light, and the weapon head drawing a fiery circle after itself. The creature saw the danger and swerved to the side, taking the relatively harmless dagger blow to its belly and avoiding the swipe from Keenfire. The axe had missed by a hair's breadth. But the long spur of a crow's beak smote it on the kneecap.
"Ah, how do you like my brother's axe, froggy?"
came Ironheart's malicious laugh, as he jerked the half of his weapon to bring the monster down.
"You didn't think that I would hold back when I can kill this beast, did you, scholar?"
The creature yelled out. In the high, elf-like tones, the animal sounds of an orc voice could be heard. Then it thrust its hand out and grabbed Ironheart by the shoulder. The Alfar runes on its forearms started to glow. The dwarf cried out, held stubbornly fast to the handle of his crow's beak, and kept pulling.
"Mind out!"
Tungdil swung Keenfire again. This time the blade bit home, and the monster's forearm sheared off, together with the wrist guards and the chains. The enemy stared at the severed arm and at its own gushing black blood, staggered backwards, and launched itself howling from the floor. In spite of its injury and the crow's beak in its knee, it managed to jump onto the next roof. Thatch and shingles tumbled down to the street. The monster had gone. Goda ran off after it.
"Stop! Come back!"
Ironheart crouched on the floor. A cloud of steam rose from his shoulder, and there was a smell of burnt flesh, hot iron, and scorched leather.
"Look at that! Froggy's got me,"
he spoke through clenched teeth.
"We nearly did for it, though."
Tungdil saved his remonstrations. The pain was punishment enough for his friend. The mail tunic had heated up with the effect of the magic and had burnt through all the layers of clothing, stenciling a black pattern.
"You are mad, Boindil," he said, helping him to his feet. "Let's find Goda."
The dwarf girl was back already. In her hand she bore the bloodied crow's beak, its spur missing.
"I heard it break and went off to sea," she explained, handing the weapon to her master. "That fine spur," he grumbled, examining the damage and running his hands over the jagged edge. "I'll have to get it repaired."
Goda slipped under his arm to support him, and he used the remains of the crow's beak as a stick.
"You must rest now, and get that wound looked at." "Oh, that's nothing," he said, playing it down. "I've had worse than that, great gaping wounds with blood and guts spilling out. A bit of burnt skin is not tragic."
Tungdil looked at the group of dwarves round Dergard, then at Rizava's body, already starting to grow cold.
"So, now we have only two Magi," he murmured. "We'll have to protect them well. This won't be the last attack."
He gave the signal to return to their quarters and was just about to send a messenger to call in the assembly when a soldier came running up.
"There you are, Tungdil Goldhand. King Bruron is looking for you everywhere. The monster has stolen the final diamond," gasped the man. "It happened during the performance. It surprised us all. We had no chance to stop it. We need you there so they can decide what to do next."
"Damn! The Froggy had the stone, and we've let it escape," groaned Ironheart. "Oh, Vrakas, how did that happen?"
Tungdil exhaled sharply and looked at Circa. "The dwarves and the undergroundlings have one thing in common, at least." He wanted to clap her on the shoulder in acknowledgement, but put his hand on her back instead, and to his own surprise left it there. She held a strong attraction for him. He watched her face, thought about that kiss, and would have gladly repeated it.
"Now, right now."
"Courage?"
she said, laughing.
"Exactly,"
he agreed swiftly, because he had left far too long a pause and had been staring at her. His behavior had been noted by Ironheart and Goda. He swiftly took his hand away from Circa's back. First, he had to talk to Belindis. They hurried through Parista's lanes and narrow streets, now full of guards.
"One more thing, Tungdil Goldhand," the messenger addressed him. "We found a dead body in your room. It looks as if he had been stabbed and died as a result of his injuries."
"That can't be so,"
Tungdil replied at once, as they approached the assembly marquee. "He was an intruder I confronted. I wounded him on the leg and on his side.
The injuries weren't dangerous."
"Very strange. I saw the dead man myself, and I assure you, the body had been carefully slit right up the middle."
"The Froggy! The monster got to him as well,"
Ironheart exclaimed, looking at Dergard and the dwarf guards who surrounded him.
"Don't leave him for a second, even if he needs to have a shit, right?"
Tungdil and Circa exchanged glances, and he could read her thoughts. The monster might have ripped the man to pieces, chucked him off a roof, torn his throat out, but it would never have sliced him through with a clean, sharp blade. He would know more when he had seen the body. The undergroundling came to his side, her hand this time on his back. She put her face down to his ear.
"I think you have a traitor in your midst, Tungdil," she whispered.
He shared her assumption. The thirdlings had a long arm, and it reached all the way to Parista. Girdlegard, Kingdom of Goregar, Parista, Summer 6241st, Solar Cycle. "Under the circumstances, I don't think it would be advisable to split our forces," said Ortger. "Tungdil Goldhand must protect the Magus with Keenfire until he is able to defend himself against the attacks from the Unslayables and the monsters." He regarded the men and women in the assembly. "Besieging Toboribor seems pointless now. Soldiers cannot combat these powers. Not now the enemy holds the genuine diamond." He indicated Durgard, who was sitting between Gandagar and Tungdil. "Let us send him and the dwarfs to Weyen to seek out the island." Tungdil rose.
"Indeed. The sooner we take Durgard and Lot Ionan to the source, the better."
He moved over to the map of Girdlegard. "The Unslayables will need to find a way to use the stone. The Eoil stole it from evil, but transformed it into a power for good. I don't think the Alfar will immediately work out how to use it." He circled Toboribor with his finger on the map. "And we should keep the siege going. We ought to send raiding parties into the caves to harass the Unslayables. Have you considered why they never set out themselves to find the diamonds?" Tungdil paused. "I think they are too weak, and so they sent out their creatures instead. We must not give them a moment's rest, even if it means risking the lives of more of our troops. If they acquire the stone's power before we revive Lot Ionan, and before Durgard can cast any spells, we are lost." He sat down.
"Are any better suited to combat in the caves than the children of the smith?"
Regalian's question was friendly.
"It would be madness to send such experienced fighters out to storm an island when they're invaluable underground, because they can see in the dark better than a human or an elf."
She looked at Gandagar.
"I trust the dwarves, Your Majesty. You should send your warriors to Toboribor, every man you can spare from duty on the gates."
Tungdil grew hot under the collar. He cursed the fact that there had been no opportunity to give the High King Sunderland's report about the broker. He sensed a trap in the elf princess's suggestion. He could not pin it down. Her words had seemed eminently sensible. Dwarfs were indeed excellent at fighting in tunnels. Serka, standing behind Tungdil, now leaned forward.
"That broker is up to something," she warned,
reinforcing his unease. Gandagar, however, was flattered by Regalian's words and was ready to accept the proposal.
"You are right, Your Highness, but I must insist it should be our people who take the Thirdling's Island. If the other sovereigns are in agreement, I shall send our warriors to Toboribor."
Pain was audible in his voice. The sedative herbs were only a slight help in stilling the agony from his injured shoulder and mutilated arm. All those present in the assembly admired his stamina.
"It will take too long," Tungdil objected. "At least 60 orbits. We would be wasting precious time. The cave attacks must start much sooner than that."
Queen Issachar had not yet, luckily for Tungdil, accepted Regalian's idea.
"We mustn't forget that there may still be traitors in the dwarf tribes looking to make common cause with our enemies."
"And if this were so, Queen Issachar, we should be the ones exposed to them in the tunnels of Toboribor, not your people,"
Gandagar interjected.
"Let that be our concern. If there are 10 traitors among my 5,000 warriors, what harm can they do?"
"I agree with Regalian," said Ortger, smiling at the elf princess. "The dwarves know what they're doing, and we can keep this area safe. My soldiers are used to moving in the mountains and can secure the peaks." While the rulers gave their assent, one by one, Tungdil hurried to Gandagar's side.
"The elves are not to be trusted," he whispered.
He gave a quick summary of Sunderland's story.
"If you ask me, it looks as if the same thing is happening here as the undergroundlings suffered."
Gandagar had listened carefully, his eyes closed. Then he looked at Serka.
"How long have you known these undergroundlings?" he asked Tungdil. "You know how long."
And you think you can trust what they say?
Your Majesty,
he raised his hand.
No, Tongdil. Our peoples have been living in harmony for many cycles now. Now they have sent envoys to impart their knowledge to us.
His eyes sought Tongdil's.
Apart from the word of the undergroundling dwarves, whose origins are questionable, have you...
Gandukar, you...
Enough!
Came the unusually sharp command. Sweat was collecting on the king's brow. The effort of controlling the pain was too much.
Everyone knows their origins are in doubt. And until I've seen one of these supposedly harmless orcs they called Ubariu, and been given proof of their good intentions, I shall stick to my opinion.
His brown eyes were resolute.
Even if I believed you, the others here would not. Not without evidence.
He lowered his head.
Do you have evidence?
Tongdil clamped his jaws so tightly shut that they hurt.
Do you have this proof, Tongdil Goldhand?
Repeated Gandagar. No, I don't, he admitted reluctantly. He was near to despair. If only the injured elf back at the inn would regain consciousness and could speak.
No. Then I must keep silent on this matter. Promise me at least you'll warn our warriors about the elves, begged Tongdil. I shall.
Gandagar turned his attention again to the assembly. The great and the good of Girdlegard were unanimous now. Even Queen Issachar had accepted Princess Regalin's suggestion.
It is decided. The united fighting force of dwarves will set off for Toboribor. The thirdlings and secondlings will form the vanguard, he announced, wiping the perspiration from his forehead.
His words were greeted with applause. Sundalan could stand it no longer. His request had not been considered. He raised his hand and waited until the clapping ceased.
Do we get the stone back when you have defeated the unslayables?
No,
answered the elf princess at once.
I think we should let Lotharionan decide, said Tongdil in an effort to avoid a dispute. He will know best what the diamond's power is.
In my opinion, it would be too dangerous to give the diamond away before it has been minutely examined.
Regalin gave the undergroundling a gracious smile.
Don't misunderstand me. I trust you, but I don't trust the Outer Lands. And you tell us that these supposedly mild-natured orcs have a... Was it a rune master?
Sunderland nodded.
They have a rune master who is versed in magic. The last thing we want is an orc with limitless magic powers, not even in the Outer Lands.
Then you are condemning our land to destruction, Broker,
snarled Sunderland.
And if creatures from the Black Abyss find their way to Girdlegard, then think on this day, and on these words of the Broker.
We have the Children of the Smith guarding our gateways, she replied calmly. So far they have failed only the once to defend us. It will not happen again. Is there an alliance stronger than this?
Sunderland grabbed hold of his weapons with both hands, as if needing them for support. Or perhaps it was the princess's throat he imagined in his grasp.
It is typical of your people to spread insults or poison. It is not for nothing we have eradicated them in our realm.
Regalin raised her eyebrows, smiling still. She had achieved her goal. She had the undergroundling breaking through the thin ice she had led him onto.
You have done what? Whispered Queen Wei.
Grown suddenly pale.
Then Broker means elf and not alpha, said Issachar, her voice toneless. We are sharing a conference table with creatures from the same creator as the orcs who have wiped out all the elves in their land.
You misunderstand, Tongdil objected, trying to salvage what he could. They had to do this. The Eoil stole their diamond and incited the elves to violence against them. They could not see clearly.
He was gathering all his courage to speak his suspicions out loud, but Rejalin was ahead of him.
"Then there is no question of giving you the diamonds, Sundalin. My people will never let that happen."
Her beautiful features displayed arrogance and ice-cold determination.
"If you should ever get possession of the stone, you will lose it again through our doing, whether it be in Girdlegard or in the Outer Lands."
Her bodyguard behind her put their hands on the pommels of their swords.
"It is better if you leave," said Gandagar to Sundalin. "And you, Princess Rejalin, watch your words before they launch something that cannot be stopped."
The undergroundlings left the assembly tent. After a brief hesitation, Tungdil followed them out. When he was halfway through the lobby, he turned on his heel.
"We shall meet in Taboribor," he told the gathering.
He made no bow to them.
"May your gods stand by you, and may they open your eyes, your majesties all, before it is too late."
He left Ireheart and Goda in his wake, together with Fergus and Rodario. What remained was an uncomfortable, oppressive silence. Nobody spoke. Bruron closed the meeting. There were tasks enough before them and issues in the air that neither the elves nor humans nor dwarves wished to discuss. Girdlegard, Queendom of Weyern, 100 miles west of Gastinga, summer 6241st solar cycle. They were taking far too long to get from Parista to the shores of the lake where their ship was waiting. There were many reasons for the delay. Unexpected rainfall meant the cart with Lot Ionan's heavy statue was getting bogged down. Then Durgard fell sick, and they had to stop over at a farm until the fever passed. They could not take risks with his life, and at the same time, they must not deplete their force by splitting into two groups. The axe Keenfire could not be wielded in two places at once. Tungdil sat with Rodario and Fergus in the farmer's parlour studying a map. This was a rare document that actually showed the Weyern territory now under floodwater. They were trying to guess the location of the disappearing island. Ireheart and Goda were doing sentry rounds with the guards. They had 100 secondling dwarves and 12 undergroundlings led by Circa, even if Boindil did not approve. He was also far from approving of the apparent flirtation between Tungdil and Circa. He had made his views clear to his friend after Circa made no attempt to conceal her affections. Rodario raised his head.
"Is our esteemed Boindil in a bad mood?" he asked Tungdil. "I just heard him yelling at the guards again."
"It's the weather. Dwarves can't stand rain, and he's hot-blooded and spoiling for a fight."
Tungdil went on poring over the chart. They'd got a short list of 5 locations.
"Can the island travel along underwater?" he asked Fergus.
"So, it's his hot blood, is it?"
Rodario stepped over to the window.
"Or is it his pupil?"
He watched them practicing in the barn. At first glance, it all seemed straightforward, but his dramatic training had sharpened his senses to signs of physical attraction.
"I get the feeling there are sparks flying there."
He turned to Tungdil.
"Yes, definite sparks."
"Best stay well out of that," said Tungdil with a wry smile.
He was keen to avoid discussion of feelings and attraction, for fear he and Circa might be the actor's next target. Fergus drank the tea the farmer's wife had brought them. Still underweight and pale, he would sometimes sit in the corner all day saying nothing. Other times he'd be completely normal. The effects of whole cycles in captivity would not be easy to get over.
"Yes, it can," he said in answer to Tungdil's question. "I made a system of tubes and chambers that fill with water or steam. If the valves are opened and the contents expelled, it propels itself slowly forward."
"Not good."
Tungdil leaned back in his seat.
"Then it could be absolutely anywhere."
"No, It can't move fast. It's a mountain we're talking about, creeping along under the water.
He drew a ring round the place they presumed was its last sighting. It would be roughly in this area.
It has to come up every so often.